Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. The election is in just 25 days. Californians began receiving their ballots this week, and drop-off locations opened on Tuesday. The last day to register to vote in California is on Monday, October 21st. For more information on voter registration or to check your voter status, you can go to vote.org or the Secretary of State's website, sos.ca.gov/elections. You can also find many resources on our website, kalw.org. Click News and then Your Call. On today's show, we will discuss a few of the state's 10 propositions. They would allow the state to borrow money for schools and to fight global warming, lower voter approval requirements for local housing and infrastructure, limit forced labor in state prisons, and reaffirm the right of same-sex couples to marry. If you have any questions about ballot measures, or if you'd like to talk about what you're watching, how you're planning to vote, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Today, we're joined by two members of the CalMatters reporting team. CalMatters has once again put together a fantastic voting guide, which you can find at calmatters.org. Carolyn Jones reports on K through 12 education. Carolyn will tell us more about Proposition 2, which would provide $8.5 billion to K through 12 schools and $1.5 billion to community college to renovate, fix, and construct facilities. Hi, Carolyn. Thanks so much for joining us again.
Sure. Good morning. Happy to be here.
Great to have you. Joe Garcia is a formerly incarcerated writer and California local news fellow with CalMatters. Joe will walk us through Proposition 6, which would amend the California Constitution to prohibit the state from punishing inmates with involuntary work assignments and from disciplining those who refuse to work, according to CalMatters voter guide. Joe Garcia spent more than a decade incarcerated at different prison facilities, including San Quentin. When he was there, he reported for the San Quentin News on everything from the COVID pandemic to San Quentin's first Pride celebration. Joe's work has appeared in many publications, including The New Yorker and The Washington Post. He was released from High Desert State Prison in Susanville a little less than 4 weeks ago. Hi, Joe. Thank you so much for joining us.
Good morning. Glad to be here.
Well, it's great to have you, Joe. You have written so many incredible pieces, one from last April in the Prison Journalism Project called How Love Gets Me Through Solitary Confinement. Alone in San Quentin, a single phone call assures me I will be okay. And then you wrote that New Yorker piece last September, which got so much attention, called Listening to Taylor Swift in Prison. Her music makes me feel that I'm still part of the world left behind. And I remember this piece. You write, the first time I heard about Taylor Swift, I was in a Los Angeles County jail waiting to be sent to prison for murder. Sheriffs would hand out precious copies of the LA Times, and they would be passed from one reader to the next. Back then, I swore that Prince was the best songwriter of my lifetime, and I thought Swift's rise to teenage stardom was an injustice. Joe, can you first, before you tell us about just the time that you spent in prison, can you tell us about how you became a writer? Because this New Yorker story got so much attention on social media.
Well, I've always been comfortable using the written form to communicate. I was a honor student in high school. I was an editor and a writer for my high school newspaper. So it's never been a career choice necessarily. It's just always been a way for me to communicate and get my thoughts down on paper. So I've always been comfortable with that form. And then while I was incarcerated, I noticed this thing called the San Quentin News, and I would read it while I was at other facilities, hoping to maybe someday transfer to San Quentin. And honestly, reading it, you know, with the type of confidence I have in my own capabilities, I just looked at it like I can write better than what I'm seeing in the newspaper. And if I ever land at San Quentin, it'll be a blessing for them to have someone of my skill set working on the newspaper. And so as soon as I got there, I bombarded the workspace and was like, here I am, guys, you're lucky to have me. And, you know, through just sheer will, I ended up being on staff and finding success as a reporter there.
Wow, that's a really great way to think about it. As I said in the intro, you spent more than a decade incarcerated at different prison facilities, and you got out just a little less than 4 weeks ago. What has life been like for you since you got out?
It's wonderful. It's so hard to really compartmentalize just all the beautiful opportunities that have sprung forth for me. And a lot of it is sort of like, did I manifest this myself? Did I get lucky? A lot of it is the power of positive thinking, as you know, as cliched as that may be. But I've been extremely optimistic and positive for most of my journey. And the Taylor Swift article kind of speaks about that, just in the sense that Taylor Swift's music and her lyrics and just her whole image and media presence is based on like positivity and like the beauty of romance and hope and redemption and figuring things out as you evolve. So all that stuff really spoke to me, and it's just very parallel to my own incarcerated journey.
Joe, it seems like so much has changed over the past, say, decade, where people behind bars are writing more. We've got Uncuffed at KALW, which is an amazing podcast of people behind bars telling their own stories. And they're also now working for the first time in a women's prison. And that's going to be incredible, because it's so rare to hear from women who spent time behind bars or who are behind bars, unless you're really involved and connected. Can you talk about that? Because society tends to talk about people behind bars, or when there's crime or I mean, I've seen this in San Francisco, where people so casually talk about how we just need to arrest more people and lock them up, and that will solve a lot of our problems. And while that's happening, we're not really hearing from people who are behind bars. So can you talk about that? Why it is so important for you, for example, to have so many platforms to share your experiences of life behind bars, and how that's changing so much?
I think it comes down to just the impact of storytelling. I say this all the time to writing groups and people who I'm trying to encourage to write more. Everybody has a story. Even the minuscule details of your life that you may think are mundane, somebody else may find very relative to their own experience, or they might find sort of fascinating. So as an incarcerated writer, so many of the little details about being put in shackles or being locked in your cell all day during COVID, we just sort of take that for granted as almost like boring, but a lot of people want to hear about that reality and that experience. And so I think when you talk about arresting all these people to get them off the streets, or however some folks, conservatives, you know, law and order people may package that, how about actually getting the stories of, you know, how did this person come to steal catalytic converters or shoplift day in and day out, or, you know, get addicted to drugs? Or there's just so many layers to it. And I think the storytelling process puts people more on an even ground, because we're so similar, right? So the most stringent Republican politician and, you know, the crack addict or whatever, the heroin addict, there's such a similarity in their humanities if they actually sit down and talk to each other and learn about each other's realities.
Right. And I think that's why having you on the show to talk about Proposition 6 is so important. But then also Proposition 36 in California would increase penalties for theft and drug trafficking. According to CalMatters, Prop 36 would reclassify some misdemeanor theft and drug crimes as felonies. The measure would create a new category of crime, a, quote, treatment mandated felony. People who don't contest the charges would complete drug treatment instead of going to prison. But if they don't finish treatment, they face up to 3 years in prison. So the question is, how is that going to better society? How is that going to better the person? And just to give listeners a sense of who's behind this, The people who are for this have raised almost $15 million. This includes the California Chamber of Commerce, the California Republican Party, Walmart, Target, Home Depot. Those against say that no studies on criminal justice or homelessness support the idea that harsher punishment prevents crime or gets people off the streets. They've raised almost $5 million. They include Governor Gavin Newsom, the ACLU, and the California Democratic Party. So again, I really urge you to go to calmatters.org. They do such a good job of laying out what these propositions do. Following the money is so important. That's also up there. So let's talk about Prop 6. So this would limit forced labor in state prisons. According to CalMatters, it would amend the California Constitution to prohibit the state from punishing inmates with involuntary work assignments and from disciplining those who refuse to work. Can you tell us how this actually works in prison?
Yeah. In prison, when you're incarcerated, you can arbitrarily get assigned a job, and it's your obligation to report to work. And if you don't report to work, you're subject to disciplinary infractions. I mean, there's so many layers to it, right? Like, you're assessed on a point system for your security level, and so staying out of trouble, your security level slowly goes down through the point system. Having a job increases the amount of points that are taken off as you decrease your security level, right? So it's in your best interest to have a job theoretically and report to work. But in this day and age and in this day and culture, I mean, that's just not for everybody. You know, there are guys who are trying to get like a bachelor's degree or even a master's degree, and they'd rather not work and just pursue their own personal endeavors, which you would think would be a good thing. And they arbitrarily get assigned a job, and now, you know, 5, 6, 7 hours of their day, 4 or 5 days a week, they have to go somewhere that they don't want to go. And it's just bad for everybody, because why would you want an employee in a workspace who doesn't want to be there? That's not at all the way the real world works. And so when you're talking about rehabilitation and modeling real life, preparing us for real life is about finding a job you're comfortable with and finding a work environment where everybody has like the same goals. And so that's just kind of one indication of how backwards this whole thing is.
According to CalMatters, of about 90,000 inmates, the state's prison system employs nearly 40,000 who complete a variety of tasks such as construction, yard work, cooking, cleaning, and firefighting. Do people behind bars have a choice about what kind of work they do?
Theoretically, yeah. I mean, like the firefighting, so many jobs are coveted, right? And so that's why the forced servitude is just kind of an asinine proposition, because, you know, like you said, 90,000 incarcerated people, 40,000 jobs available. Obviously, there's more than enough people to fill those jobs voluntarily. And like for the firefighting thing, there's like a huge wait list. Guys are adamantly doing everything they can to be in a position to be a incarcerated firefighter. And so that's just one example. There are guys who love working in the kitchen. There are guys who abhor working in the kitchen. And so the burden is on us. It's always on the incarcerated individual. We have to navigate the system and try and resolve these issues. And if we don't, we'll end up with a job we don't want and a supervisor who is waiting to write us up for not reporting to work.
Most people behind bars earn less than 74 cents an hour, although firefighters can earn as much as $10 a day. California's minimum wage is $16 an hour, and state law permits the corrections department to pay up to half of that rate. So 74 cents an hour? Can you just talk more about that and how many hours are worked? And then what are you required to buy behind bars? And what does 74 cents an hour, if you work, say, half the day, depending on how many hours, what does that get you?
Not a lot, especially with the way economy and prices have gone since COVID. basically, the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation barely supplies the incarcerated individual with anything. I mean, you might get one or two bars of really cheap soap to use, and maybe if you're lucky, you can find some tooth powder. So, you know, just from a hygiene sense, just basic, you know, a bar of soap, toothpaste, a toothbrush, you're really going to have to buy those things yourself. And so that's why you need family support. That's why you need a job that can at least give you the bare minimum. I mean, we have a canteen where we buy things to sustain ourselves, but, you know, even the diet and the things that are available, it's kind of like going to 7-Eleven or like a convenience store. You know, imagine if your whole diet was just based on what's available at an AMPM or something, right? But that's kind of the canteen options, and you need money for that. So if you don't have your family or loved ones funneling funds into your inmate account, you need to work. And so that little 75 cents an hour might add up to like $15, $20, $30, $40 a month to spend on soap, toothpaste, sodas, seafood, you know, tuna, whatever, just to get by. But yeah, if you didn't have any money or any means of providing for yourself, it's a pretty gruesome environment in there.
We're speaking with Joe Garcia, a formerly incarcerated writer and California local news fellow with Cal Matters. We're talking with Joe about Proposition 6, which would amend the California Constitution to prohibit the state from punishing inmates with involuntary work assignments and from disciplining those who refuse to work, according to Cal Matters. In a few minutes, we'll speak with Carolyn Jones, who reports for Cal Matters on K-12 education, and she'll tell us more about Proposition 2. If you have any questions about these props, or if you're following other props, there are 10 on California's ballot. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Cal Matters says Prop 6 is on the ballot. Why is it on the ballot? California was not a slave state, but it does have a history of forced law. Lawmakers created a reparations task force and directed it to address historical inequities that harmed Black residents. The task force recommended changing the state constitution to prohibit any form of enslavement as one of 14 key priorities this session. So let's talk about who's supporting Proposition 6, which would limit forced labor in state prisons. According to Cal Matters, about $1 million has been raised. Supporters say prisoners are often retaliated against for turning down assignments that can be dangerous or life-threatening. It is inhumane, they say, to have to work long hours on jobs that do not contribute to future skills for little pay. Supporters include ACLU, California Action, the California Democratic Party, California Teachers Association, California Black Legislative Caucus. And then those that are opposed have not raised any money. An official ballot argument against the measure has not been filed, but a few Republican legislators voted against it. Opponents also include the California Republican Party and the Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association. Again, it's Prop 6, limiting forced labor in state prisons. Can you tell us, Joe, does this at all contribute to future skills once people get out of prison?
It depends on the job. And so that's why people in prison, incarcerated individuals, should be free to pursue whatever job or whatever rehabilitative programming that fits their needs. And so, yeah, you know, there are vocational, there are certain jobs that might in some way prepare you to be a upstanding work-oriented citizen once you reenter. But at the same time, just forcing somebody to work or arbitrarily assigning them a job, it kind of makes them bitter at the system. And so they're incarcerated inside a system that they have a lot of resentment for. And so that in no way contributes to having a positive mindset about society.
We should also say that supporters cite the growing number of states that have adopted similar measures, including Colorado, Alabama, Tennessee, and Vermont, though California would have stronger language against retaliation toward inmates. So that's Proposition 6. And again, I just want to mention once again, Prop 36. This is such an important one. It would increase penalties for theft and drug trafficking. It would reclassify some misdemeanor theft and drug crimes as felonies. And this is important to follow the money. Supporters have raised almost $15 million on this, including the California Republican Party, Walmart, Target, Home Depot. They say that they're pitching Prop 36 as a way to combat homelessness. Those against say there are no studies showing that harsher punishment prevents crime or gets people off the streets. The opposing side has raised almost $5 million, and they include the California Democratic Party, League of Women Voters, ACLU, Governor Gavin Newsom. Do you have any thoughts or anything to say, Joe, on Prop 36?
Yeah, I mean, I probably too many thoughts, but basically we know from the era of mass incarceration that locking people up and giving them extended sentences doesn't work. It doesn't serve the community. It doesn't serve the individual. When you overcrowd prisons and put people in those situations, they end up becoming worse than when they started off their incarceration. It's a volatile environment. We're forced to take things out on each other inside the incarcerated community. And so you don't want to overcrowd prisons. You don't want to lock people up. I do understand the argument about various crimes that it seems like they're a slap on the wrist, but I don't think the answer is just more severe penalties. It just doesn't work. I mean, however you want to frame it politically, if you look at the history from like the 90s, all the way up till now when there was like, you know, 140,000 people incarcerated, maybe even more than that. It just doesn't work. The system isn't built for that.
Joe Garcia spent more than a decade incarcerated at different prison facilities, including San Quentin. He was released from High Desert State Prison in Susanville a little less than a month ago. Joe is a California local news fellow with Cal Matters, and we've been talking about Proposition 6. Before we go to Prop 2, let's take a caller. Lauren is calling in from Santa Cruz. Hi, Lauren.
Hi. Hi. I have a question. Are the jobs in the prison just related to the prison, or doesn't the prison system, like, contract out these jobs and they make a bunch of money and then they only pay the guys 74 cents and they're making a whole bunch of money by doing these things for other companies?
Yeah, that's a great question. Thank you. Joe, are these jobs just related to prison, or are they contracted out to companies?
Most of the really low-paid jobs, like the, you know, I got paid 28 cents an hour when I was a reporter for the San Quentin News. So the 74 cents an hour, or that's like almost a new age improvement over recent years. But yeah, those types of jobs are mainly like maintaining the prison, working in the kitchen. And, you know, you're doing things that benefit the entire institution. If prisoners refuse to work, officers would have to serve food and mop and sweep and clean. And so it's in everyone's best interest to treat those workers well and to not put them in a sense where it's forced servitude. But yeah, most of the jobs are about maintaining the prison and stuff that goes on within the institution.
All right. Well, thank you so much for that call, Lauren. Now we are going to talk about Proposition 2, which would borrow $10 billion to build schools and colleges. And Carolyn Jones reports on K-12 education. She's going to tell us more about Prop 2. Carolyn, Prop 2 would provide $8.5 billion to K-12 schools and $1.5 billion to community colleges to renovate, fix, and construct facilities. How would this money be distributed, and who would decide how it will be spent?
Well, the money is distributed mostly through matching grants, which means that school districts have to find some way to raise their own money. That puts some like lower income school districts and smaller school districts at a real disadvantage there. So the districts that stand to benefit the most from this are larger districts like Los Angeles Unified, San Francisco Unified, and so forth.
Wow. So how do schools find matching grants?
Well, they have to pass their own local bonds. And in lower income areas, that can be tricky because the property values tend to be lower. So even if you are able to pass a bond, you're just not going to be able to raise that much money. And in some parts of California, it's very hard to pass local bonds. There might be a lot of retirees who vote against those things, or people just don't have extra money to support, bond measures like, school facilities. So it can be a real challenge.
CalMatters says, according to the Public Policy Institute of California, 38% of students attend schools that do not meet the state's minimum safety standards. What does that mean exactly?
That means a lot of broken air conditioners, leaky roofs, heaters that don't work, playgrounds that are cracked. The list goes on. Dry rot, mold. Pretty much up and down the state, there are schools that are falling apart, and that has a real impact on students.
Right. And so obviously those students and those schools are the ones that need this money the most. Is there any way to parse this out? So if 38% of students attend schools that do not meet the state's minimum safety standards, given what you said about how this money would be distributed through matching grants, do we have any idea how much of this money would go to those 38% of students?
Well, the state does have certain, they do set aside some of the money for, hardship funds, I think they call it, for school districts that really are in a bind. And, they just don't have the money to fix, whatever needs to be fixed. And then also there is a little bit of a sliding scale in there. So lower income districts can get a little bit more, but it's not nearly enough to give them what they need. So, everyone agrees. I think this is not the ideal way to fix broken schools, but right now it's the best system we have.
What message does this send, Carolyn, to students who are dealing with mold and broken air conditioners? I mean, we just went through a heat wave in the Bay Area. It was so hot. San Francisco had such a hot Sunday. What message does this send to young people?
Well, the students I've talked to say, it can be really demoralizing, but not just students, teachers too, and other staff people who work at schools really, it's no fun to go work at a place that's, it's unsafe, it's falling apart. And there's been lots of research that links the condition of school buildings to academic achievement. Students who go to schools that are safe and comfortable tend to do well on academic tests. They have higher attendance, which is not a surprise, fewer incidents of discipline. So there's lots of benefits. And the other thing I should point out, too, is that there's some places in California where you have some of these districts side by side. Like you might have a really affluent district with beautiful school buildings. They look like little Ivy League colleges or something. And then you have, just a few miles down the road, you have schools that are falling apart. And that can be very demoralizing for the students.
And you say that based on how the system is set up, this is the best that we can ask for at this point with Prop 2?
Well, this is the system that California has had for decades. And so there's a lot of people that say, it's really unfair the way it is and they would like to change it. But right now, that's just kind of what we're stuck with. There's a public interest law firm called Public Advocates that's threatened to sue the state over this system, depending on what happens with this bond in November. So there, and legislators have been talking about it on and off, trying to look for ways to fix this and make it more fair. But right now, this is where we are.
We also learn, thanks to all of the work that you do at CalMatters, unlike many other states, California does not pay for school repairs through a permanent funding stream. Money comes entirely from state and local bonds. The state's last school facilities bond, a $15 billion proposal in 2020, failed, leaving the state's school repair account nearly empty. So why is this the case? And does it work in other states to pay directly for repairs through a permanent funding stream?
Yeah, that's the way most other states do it. California has never done it that way. And, it can be complicated to try to undo these systems. And also there's some school districts that really benefit from it. Because there's a limited pot of money, every district wants to get a bigger piece of the pie, and some of these districts, such as LA Unified, have lobbyists in Sacramento who have, they have a vested interest in keeping the system as it is. So that's one thing that we're going against. And, you know, you're right, California, the only way we can fix schools in California is through bonds. So it's either state money or local money. In some parts of California, it's really easy to pass local bonds, and so it's not such a big deal. But in some areas, it's really almost impossible.
We have a good question for a listener who says, from Leslie, this is a really good question. I've been wanting to do a show about this, actually. She says, where does California lottery money go? Wasn't that for schools?
Yeah, that's just a drop in the bucket, though. It's just, I mean, I think Public Policy Institute of California recently estimated that state schools need $100 billion worth of repairs at this point. Wow. And this bond, for example, is only $8.5 billion. So, yeah, I mean, the need far outstrips the money that's available.
Mm-hmm. What else can be done about this, given that it sounds like in many cases, it's an emergency? Students, especially going to low-income schools that have been neglected, really need a lot of money. What else can be done, if anything?
Well, I think superintendents in those districts and small school districts, what they want to see is just more money set aside for them, because they don't really have many other options. They just want a bigger slice of the pie. And they want a little bit more help from the state, because sometimes getting this money, you know, it's very complicated. There's a ton of paperwork, and you have to work with the state architect and so forth. And for a small school district that might just, you know, the principal is also the bus driver right. and the math teacher, wow. they just don't have the bandwidth to do all this. And so they want more help from the state, getting the money, doing the paperwork, just a little bit more assistance.
Well, and it's interesting, Carolyn, because a lot of people say we can't just keep throwing money at problems. But the fact of the matter is, in this case, money is needed. And I'm sure there's a lot of stories about waste and that kind of thing, which is very important. But when you're talking about mold and broken air conditioners, the fact of the matter is you need money to fix it.
That's right. Yeah. There's no easy way around it. Although, you know, I talked to some school districts where they're so desperate, you know, they bring in parent volunteers to do the work. You know, they basically have a bake sale, you know, to raise money to, you know, fix the playground or that kind of thing. So
right.
students are getting, schools are getting desperate to try to make these repairs.
So again, Proposition 2 would provide $8.5 billion to K-12 schools and $1.5 billion to community colleges to renovate, fix, and construct facilities, but the money would be distributed through matching grants, and that means that these schools would have to find matching money, and in more affluent districts, they can do that, but it's much, much harder for smaller and low-income districts to raise enough money to pay for school repairs. And they often, as Carolyn said, cannot pass local bonds at all. So CalMatters reports that on the for side, those who support Proposition 2, $6.6 million has been raised. They say the money is crucial for making basic safety improvements. A lot of people are supporting this. The California Labor Federation, California Chamber of Commerce, California Federation of Teachers, the Republican and Democratic parties of California are endorsing this. No money has been raised on the no on two side. Opponents say the state should include school repairs in its regular budget. And once again, the Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association opposes Prop 2. What are you hearing from voters on Proposition 2?
Well, initially, you know, back in June, I think the polling said that voters were kind of wishy-washy on it, a little iffy, because the economy was, you know, also a little wishy-washy. The most recent poll, which came out last month, 54% of potential voters said that they favored it, and it only needs a simple majority to pass. So it looks like it's headed that direction.
And Carolyn, are there any other props that you're following that you'd like to briefly bring up, or anything else on the ballot, given that it's always so long in California?
Well, I cover schools, so that's the main one that I'm looking at right now. It'll be interesting to me to see how much support there is for it, and then also if Public Advocates does intend to file a lawsuit to stop it after the election. So that's what I'll be looking at.
Carolyn Jones reports on K through 12 education for CalMatters. We've been talking about Proposition 2. We've also been speaking with Joe Garcia, a formerly incarcerated writer and California local news fellow with CalMatters. Joe walked us through Proposition 6. Carolyn and Joe, thank you so much for your reporting and thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And find more information about the propositions and other issues related to the election in California. CalMatters.org puts together an incredible voter guide, and we will be talking about additional propositions next week on Your Call. Coming up after a break, we will continue our conversation about the climate crisis and what is at stake in the election. We will talk about the devastation of Hurricane Milton in Florida. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.